Hello, this is Meet the Writers and I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today started her professional career as an illustrator and she went on from there. But to call her just an award-winning writer would be a disservice. As well as expertly carving beautiful words of fiction and non-fiction, she's a journalist, a campaigner, a doctoral student, a literary prize judge, a speaker and a diarist. Joanna Welsh, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Hi.
Your latest book is Worlds from the World's End, and it's been described as an anti-mainstream collection, and it totally cements your reputation as one of the sharpest writers of this century, which is what you're hailed as. So I do want to discuss the book in more detail later, but just to give listeners an insight into where you come from, I should say that it contains weird, funny, timely stories. The title piece, Where Words Go Out of Fashion, there's a piece that references Freud and talks about a woman who confuses her man's bicycle for her menstrual cycle, and an extraordinary piece in which the narrator meets their own bookshelf, a fearsomely smart and funny creature who's composed of bits of all the books the narrator's never got around to reading. And these are all just fascinating. And I'd like to start there with your bookshelf, with your very first bookshelf, and what you remember reading that's forged the literary force that you've become.
My parents were both teachers and they made sure that I read a lot. My dad did a lot of recounting stories to me before I could read. I don't think he actually read them from the book. He would often just tell them, and I quite liked that, converting written text to a sort of oral tradition where stories were different every time. I read a lot of the same sorts of things that anyone else of that era would have read. I read Tolkien, I read Susan Cooper, I read Ursula Le Guin. So I read a lot of fantasy.
And in terms of your career, though, you started as an illustrator.
Yeah, I was dealing with text. I did an English degree. I started working in publishing. And I, at the time, the sort of publishing I was working in, big corporate publishing, I didn't feel tempted to continue, although now I am an editor and I do love editing. I work for indie presses and journals. I'd always drawn. I had never been encouraged particularly to take it seriously because I passed exams in with words in, which were considered more important. So I just rebelled against that and decided to teach myself to draw properly, which I did. I worked mostly for newspapers. I was always dealing with text, so I did stuff for features. I did book covers. I've done some children's book illustration. I've done stuff for animation, just everything really.
And so where and how did that transition to writer come?
Well, it was quite a sudden decision. I'd decided not to be a writer because I was very nervous of the kind of authority I'd be claiming if I went on to do that. I was worried about the idea that anything I had to say would have any importance for anyone else. And writing was really a way of dealing with things that I couldn't deal with through illustration. Illustration was always reactive. It was always dealing with someone else's content. It was never creating the subject matter and the way that it was written myself. Mm. So because of various things in my life, which were quite dramatic, most of which I've written about in Hotel, I just suddenly switched and I decided that I was at a point where I had very little to lose if I did take a gamble on being able to say anything of any relevance whatsoever.
And of course, you did take that gamble. Your first book, was that Fractal?
Fractals is a collection of short stories. Quite a few of them are in Worlds from the World's End. Now, it was with a very small press. If you find copies of that around still, you'd be lucky. That was published in 2013.
And then comes Grow a Pear, which is a short story collection. Mm-hmm. A couple of lines from this. A girl passed a penis bush growing in someone else's garden and picked a ripe dick because she couldn't resist it. Vaginas of every colour flew from tree to tree, flapping their delicate labial wings. Fantastic. Tell me about this book.
It's got one of those strange publishing histories. I was commissioned to write some erotic short stories by an American magazine, but somehow the commission sort of failed, or, you know, it never came through. And I had this material and I thought, well, what should I do with it? And you think, well, where can I submit surreal erotic short stories? Where is the market for this? I can't remember how I discovered this very small English language German publisher publishing translations into English, but also original English material in Berlin. And I just sent them my stuff and they said, yes, let's do it. Can you write any more? And so I wrote. They're really a cycle. They all fit together. You find kind of characters and body parts from other stories turning up in some of the other stories. Mm-hmm. You know, it was very popular. It's out of print now, so I hope it'll be back soon. I'd quite like to do an illustrated edition, but I don't think I want to do the illustrations for it. It's quite difficult illustrating your own work. It's thinking in two ways at the same time.
Freud seems to be a theme through a lot of your work. And in fact, Freud comes up again in Hotel, mm-hmm. which is part of Bloomsbury's Object Lessons series. His patient Dora's there. The idea of haunted space and checking into a hotel already being an admission that there's something wrong at home. Mm-hmm. And as you say, this came out of a very traumatic period in your own life where there was something wrong at home.
Yes. Well, I found that just as I had decided not to write, I was very interested in women who didn't speak for one reason or another. It wasn't a deliberate interest. I was reading Freud and I just became fascinated by his patient Dora. This was the first case that he wrote down as a narrative. And I liked the idea of this man trying to make a story out of events which were very contested. Her family told a different story, of course, because family events, it was family events that had traumatised her into not speaking. She wasn't telling any story at all. In the end, she left Freud's treatment without giving him an explanation and presumably found a more satisfying narrative conclusion herself. Mm. So I find I'm continuously interested in women not speaking. It comes up again in Seed, where I'm writing a little bit about an Ophelia character. I'm very interested in Hamlet, how Ophelia says very little, but everything she says is very sharp and pertinent. But often others speak for her. Her death is described by Gertrude. Indeed, sometimes when she's speaking, she uses lines written by other people. She talks through songs. So again, she's one of these people who says a lot by not speaking.
And saying a lot, perhaps in a ghostly space, which is what Hotel talks about how this being almost a kind of spectral realm.
Yeah, I love Freud as a cultural critic. I love Mourning and Melancholia and civilization and its discontents. And in my forthcoming book, Break Up, I write about civilization and its discontents again, which is some things I wrote less about. But yeah, the idea of ghosts, the idea of the unheimlich is very interesting. And the way that the unheimlich in Freud is very related to the heimlich, the homely, which also means the private, which then goes on to the secret, which then goes on to the secret for a reason, which then becomes the uncanny. So that explains why so many of the things we find uncanny are things which are also very domestic.
And that comes up in Vertigo, which sits, I suppose, somewhere between a collection of short stories and a novel. And it goes back to feeling inadequate at home, I suppose, the protagonist's inability to belong.
Yeah, I like writing about relationships. That collection was really put together with the excellent editorial help of Danielle Dutton of Dorothy, a publishing project, which is the most wonderful indie publisher in the States. I admired what she was doing so much that I sent her all my short story works so far, probably about 2014 at the time. And she said, well, there seem to be two sorts of stories here. There are surreal, wordy stories, which eventually became World from the Word's End. And there are stories which seem surreal, but they're really hyper-real. They're talking about events that do take place in everyday life, and a lot of them are about relationships. They're about being a mother, a daughter, a lover, a wife. And she thought that they would work very well as a collection, and so together we put it together, mm-hmm. and that was Vertigo.
Mm-hmm. And again, huge critical acclaim for that book, along with all of your others. Seed, let's return to that, because you've described it as the craziest thing you've ever done.
Yeah, well, I was looking at ways to, because I'm very interested in how we narrate ourselves, how we talk about ourselves and how we think of ourselves. I'm very interested in alternatives to the sort of narratives that we're given, the sort of narratives that would make sense in a regular novel. So where there's a beginning, a kind of formation, some sorts of achievements or difficulties that are encountered in a life. But I'm really interested in memory as it might be laid out side by side in a quite non-linear and perhaps in a sort of non-hierarchical, mm-hmm. flat plane way, which is partly to do with my interest in visual arts. I'm interested in the way we absorb information from a picture, say an illustration or a painting or, you know, a sculpture. We're seeing a lot of different things at once. We're seeing colour, we're seeing texture, form, we're seeing cultural references. And the way that we absorb it is very different from reading. I was trying to do something with reading where instead of going left to right, up to down on the page, you're skipping around a lot, and what you get left with is an overall impression which can build plot and narrative, but at the same time is admitting the kind of non-linearity of memory.
So with Seed, it's designed basically to read on a portable device, on a, on a phone. Just describe how that works.
Well, when you open it up, it has this extremely beautiful design by the illustrator Charlotte Hicks. It looks like a sort of constellation, but when you go closer to it, you find that it's a constellation made of flowers. Seed's very rural. It's about a kind of industrial landscape, a teenager growing up in a out just on the edges of a new town. So there's a lot of beauty, but there's a lot of sort of, it's quite tatty as well and quite industrial. So you can go and pick any flower, or you can follow vines between the flowers. You can switch all the vines on at once, which means you get something that approaches a kind of linear expected story type text. Or if you just choose one vine at a time, you can follow various kind of voices, various memories that go on in the protagonist's head. So you can go backwards and forwards and really choose how you read it to a great extent.
It's such fun to do, and it's free to download as well.
It is, yes. Yeah,
which
yes.
I think is...
Well, you can't really download it. You have to be online to read it. Yeah. But yes, it's at seed-story.com.
And now let's talk about Words from the World's End. So it's a collection of 18 short stories that play with the meanings of words and the ideas that they can convey. And it seems to bring together many of the ideas contained in your previous work, indeed, even some of the very same stories. Tell us about the starting point.
I find that my work kind of develops. I don't really set out with an idea in mind. So really what I'm working on is ideas that are interesting to me, and they come up in various forms, and they do repeat because I failed to work something out the first time, or I just want to take a different avenue this time. So yes, you do find themes coming up again and again in my stories, but hopefully not too similarly. The stories were all written across a period from probably about 2012 onwards, so they were very much at the same time as I was doing other work.
And it's very much a dialogue between the reader and the writer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love the idea of working with a reader on a text. I like leaving gaps for meaning. I like jokes. I like puns. I like leaving puzzles to work out.
As you said, I mean, it's very witty. There are puns, there are jokes, there are mysteries. And above all, I felt that there are questions. You're inviting us to think.
Several people have asked me, so what's the answer to this story? For instance, Enzo Ponza, which is quite a strange story. And in fact, it's so strange because I dreamed the first scene in it and then I didn't dream anymore. I've never done that before. I have written about dreams I've had in some of my stories, but I haven't made them into a story in themselves. So I did dream the first scene in which a small girl, maybe she's about 7 or 8, sees a guy on the street on his own and she takes him home and she's kidnapped him. No one ever comes for him. Nobody is willing to put up a ransom, so he ends up living with her. And someone asked me the other day, well, you know, by the end of the story, which is she's well into middle age, what is it that he symbolises? What is this strange man who never kind of explains himself and his presence is never quite explained? What does that mean? If I have answers to that myself, I would rather think that the reader has other ones. I always work assuming that the reader is bringing something to the story as well. They're bringing their experience, they're bringing their imagination, their knowledge of words, everything.
It's a fantastic story. I have so many questions about it, but perhaps we'll see those a bit later. Let's talk about the title story, because that is this extraordinary place where words just aren't fashionable anymore.
But it is the most wordy story I've written,
yes.
And it is kind of relentless puns, and I had a great deal of fun writing it. I like the fact that puns are annoying, that, you know, they're meant to be funny, but they're sort of also very annoying. They're a bit clever, that someone's pointed out that one word has two meanings or that two words have the same meaning. The framework of it is the idea of relationships where whatever you say to each other, there seems to be no communication anymore. So I thought that I would give one of the two protagonists in this sort of relationship a setting where words were disappearing from her culture. And she was writing a very long, wordy letter to her ex to explain why she wouldn't ever be able to speak to him again.
You can see how this might work, though, in terms of it suddenly becoming this trend and people going from, as you point out, saying, I live in the house by the corner, to just over there, or just pointing at something in a coffee shop. And you can see, actually, dystopian it might feel, but actually almost could be happening.
It's also picking up on this idea of anxiety over authenticity that we all have. Are our vegetables organic? Are they locally produced? This sort of what people call the kind of hipster anxieties that we have proper links to everything. You know, we live in a very globalised world and there's a great deal of anxiety over our links to our everyday processes. So if words are things that used to span the globe on the internet via any kind of method of communication, then perhaps not using words is somehow more authentic. If you think about Jonathan Swift in Gulliver's Travels, he has a little island which nobody really talks about because it's not one of the major islands in the book, but it's an island where people have stopped talking because they think it's immoral, and it's this idea of words and morality that I'm interested in. And instead they carry around sacks of things, and whenever they want to have a conversation they get something out of their sack and they show it to the other person involved. And of course they can only have very limited conversations because of the weight of the objects that they carry around with them.
It's all absolutely fascinating. I would urge people to read Worlds from the World's End. The narrators of the stories are largely unnamed, and sometimes we're not aware of their gender. And I'd like to turn to your other work around gender and literacy, your Read Women campaign.
Yes, well, that started almost by mistake. It was when I was still doing illustrations and I designed some cards with women writers, and I asked people on social media, essentially on Twitter, to contribute names of women they thought had been overlooked, should be heard from more. I got an absolutely extraordinary response. And it was meant to be a project that lasted for a month, I think January 2014. But eventually someone wrote to me and said, you should really go on with this. There's a great hunger for this as a sort of news feed, as an information service, as a focus for our activity. And you should go on with it. And in fact, I've reserved a Twitter name for you, Read Women Twitter account. And if you don't go on with it, we'll find someone who wants to. And I thought about it for a while because I didn't really want this sort of thing to take over my life. But I've managed to work on it in a way that it doesn't. And I've got three people also tweeting from the account. And so we get a good range of opinion, a good range of interests, and a good range of knowledge and information. But really, it's an echo chamber. People say Twitter is an echo chamber in a bad way. But if these names are being heard less and are being heard less loudly, this is an opportunity for, it's kind of megaphone, really.
You've also done a lot of work around age and creativity.
There seem to be quite a lot of prizes and residencies for new writers, which are also age limited. Sometimes it's under 30s, under 35s, under 40s. And it doesn't really seem to be quite right. If there were a hard and first distinction, if writers who are beginning under the age of 40 were really more disadvantaged and could be specifically said to be more disadvantaged than writers who are beginning over the age of 40 or whatever age the prizes pick, then I would be all in favour of it. And I'm certainly in favour of enterprises that try to correct imbalances that are cultural, such as gender and race imbalances in publishing. But this doesn't seem to be doing anything except assuming that people start writing at a certain age and therefore should be supported when they start writing. I think, of course, people should be supported when they start writing, and of course, young writers should be supported. But this strange cut-off date isn't doing anyone any favours. And indeed, when I've looked at things like UNESCO, who do support cities of literature, on their own website, they say that indirect discrimination is, for instance, an age limit which discriminates against, say, women who have taken time off to bring up children. But of course, it also discriminates against people who haven't felt culturally comfortable, people writing in a second language, people who had taken off time for illnesses, for disabilities, people who've had less money, who need to spend most of the time working before they can even think about taking time off to write. Writing takes time. That's why age limits are very discriminatory, because time is money, and the people who can buy the time are the people who have advantages in the first place.
And a great first novel can strike at any age. On top of all of this, you're a contributing editor to a number of different publications.
I started off as fiction editor at 3AM magazine, which is a wonderful avant-garde literary magazine which has been going about 17 years now. I absolutely loved that job. I had to cut back on it eventually because, like all of 3AM, it's run entirely by volunteers, and I started doing a PhD and didn't have so much time anymore. But I was very excited to be able to curate a selection of new writers, and I'm really excited to find that some of the people that I took a punt on have since had story collections or novels out, or are just getting their first books out this year. Particularly like to mention Ely Williams, who's a wonderful short story writer who wrote A Trib last year with Inflex Press. Isabel Wadner, whose really extraordinary novel Gaudy Bauble with Dostoevsky Wannabe last year as well. And I think this year Owen Booth, who's a fantastic writer, is having his first story collection out with Fourth Estate.
You've also got some new work coming out, and you've got one piece on internet relationships.
I have a book called Breakup, which is actually, I've been writing it since I started writing. It began as a kind of series of essays, but eventually it developed as a sort of series of essays with a fictionalised protagonist in order to give it sort of a kind of unity. So it's the first time I've written a novel, and indeed it is a romantic novel, so I'm now a romantic novelist. It's about the strange intensity of internet relationships and what it does both to our sense of place, the collapsible sense of place when people are a long way away, and also our sense of self as constructed via your connection with your significant other.
And in terms of where else you're going and where literature is going, I suppose.
That's a big question.
But it's something that in your other new work, which is part of The Digital Critic, you address.
Yes, this is a book that's just come out with OR Books. It's a wide-ranging set of essays by a number of different authors talking about the position of literature in the digital age. I've written an essay about, well, it's really re-evaluating the death of the author, which is this idea of Roland Barthes in the late 60s, was talking about the reader really having a direct relationship with the text and the author being bypassed. But of course, now that all authors are on social media, you can see what they had for breakfast, you can see them talking to their friends, unless they have, you know, private accounts, which some people do. Authors are very much encouraged to disseminate themselves as much as possible, also at festivals. There are many more festivals than there were 10 or 20 years ago. I was thinking about the kind of changed relationship between the reader and the text as it's triangulated on the author. People really want to be in touch with authors. And I don't mind that as an impulse. I'm just much more interested in where that impulse comes from and what it is that the readers are looking for when they say they kind of tweet J.K. Rowling and ask her a question.
You must have a phenomenal work ethic, because, I mean, we've talked about some of the projects that you do, but there's so much more. You've judged literary prizes, you've been a writer in residence, now you're doing a PhD. How does all this work? What is your routine?
Well, they all link up. Seed is part of my PhD because I'm writing critically now. That was my creative piece, but now I'm writing critically on certain kinds of internet-based creative acts, both art and literature, which involve words. And I'm always doing kind of a variety of things at the same time. I love collaboration. I love working with other people. I love editing. And everything sort of seems to link up. I don't really start writing a story with a very set idea of what a story is going to be. I often don't start a project with a set idea that it's going to be anything in particular. And often things come along and people come along that change that. And it ends up being several different things at the same time.
And you also design literary events for people.
It's the editorial impulse. I love bringing new work to light. I love talking about work that I love. So, yeah, I'm very happy to get things together for people. I love readings. I love reading my own work, and I love listening to other writers read theirs.
Is there anybody that is really, really exciting you? You've mentioned a few authors that you've worked with, and I just wondered if there's perhaps one or two names that really stand out for you that we should be looking out for in the next year or so.
Dubravka Ugrezic, the Croatian author, has an extraordinary book coming out this year. I think it's coming out in the States. I'm not quite sure about the UK. She's the most extraordinary essayist and fiction writer and often combines the two. And some excerpts were published just over a year ago in a magazine called Music and Literature. They're translated from Croatian into English. And they're extraordinary, really wonderful combination of personal experience, fiction, essay. And I think they're the best thing by her I've ever read. I'm looking forward so much to reading that book.
Mm-hmm. And finally, you've been a judge on the Goldsmith Prize. How useful is literary competition?
Well, it varies. I think it varies according to which literary competition it is. I love the Goldsmiths because what it's doing, it's looking for innovation in the novel form, and that's certainly something that I'm looking for and I'm pursuing in my own work as well. Literary competitions are always very difficult because only one person gets to win. So that sort of competitive mood, which is more or less forced upon writers now, is a little bit counterproductive. It sets one writer or one kind of writing against another. Grants are great. I got an Arts Council grant to develop Seed into a performance, which I've done once and I'm going to be doing at various times and in various places in 2018. I never expected to get it. I was surprised and delighted. So it's becoming a half-hour performance with amateur voices. Specifically, I wanted to, again, this theme of kind of voices and voices that aren't usually heard, I wanted to work with amateur voices recruited via whichever venue I'm working with. And I workshop them for a couple of hours on the day, and then we read from scripts, and it's a sort of polyphonic piece, so it's very musical without being music. I did it at Spike Island Arts Centre in Bristol, the premiere in December, and it was absolutely fantastic. It was a wonderful experience just because of all this variety, different qualities of voices that you don't usually get to hear. They're not smooth performance voices like you hear on the radio usually.
And in terms of literary voices, I'm so pleased to have been able to speak to one I greatly admire. Thank you so much for coming on to speak to us, Joanna Welsh. And World from the Word's End is published by And Other Stories. It's out now.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough and David Stevens. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.